Hi, I'm Jane Lindholm. I'm the host of Vermont Edition, and I just wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Tomorrow, the work begins in earnest at the State House in Montpelier as lawmakers return for the official start of the second year of the biennium. They'll be picking up where they left off last spring on some of the thorniest issues facing the state and beginning work on new issues and items that have arisen in the last 8 months or so. Vermont Edition will be there tomorrow, and we have a jam-packed show planned for you, with room for plenty of spontaneity, too. We hope to actually maybe even pluck people out of the stream of folks heading to and from the cafeteria during the lunch hour to see who they are and what they're doing on opening day, as well as making sure we talk to some of the key people who make the State House and the session run smoothly. So be sure to tune in live at noon or catch the podcast or rebroadcast later. But first, we thought we'd offer a civics lesson today. We're going to spend some time looking at how the legislature works and who works in the legislature, how a bill becomes law, why we have a biennium, and whatever else you want to know. We're curious to know what issues Vermonters are thinking about ahead of the session. So in advance, we sent VPR's Betty Smith and Anna Van Dyne out on the streets to find out.
Things that I find to be priorities are issues around equity and inclusion and diversity. And I'm very interested in the public education around ethnic studies and interested to see how that moves forward.
A legal marketplace for marijuana probably will come up this year. And I know there's some difference of opinion about how that should play out.
I have four children, so I follow the educational process very closely, and the school's consolidation issue is a hot topic in Vermont right now.
Well, we're a business owner, so minimum wage, of course, is always an issue for us, as is the family leave that I know they're talking about in the legislature.
Personally, I'm always interested in the issue of health care. I'm an advocate that we should have more centralized government-sponsored health care, that health care should be a right and not a privilege, and it should be available to everyone.
Some Vermonters there letting us know what they're interested in hearing about and thinking about and what they want the legislature to work on this session. What about you? In a little while, we're going to talk about some of the issues the legislature really is definitely going to dig in on in this year. But do you know how it all works? How bills are made? How legislative leaders talk to one another and don't talk to one another? And who's even in the legislature? What does it mean to have a citizen legislature? Do we even really have one anymore? Joining us as our guide for the next half hour or so is Bob Kinzel, veteran political and State House reporter, and of course, the Friday host of Vermont Edition. You might also hear his Ask Bob segments on Morning Edition, and this is sort of an expanded version of that. Bob, thanks for doing this with us today.
Oh, Jane, it's my pleasure. I think those folks right at the top of the show hit the issues right on the head.
I know, didn't they? And what always impresses me, and I guess is not a surprise in any way, but is impressive, is how connected Vermonters are to what's happening in the State House and to the issues that lawmakers are working on. I think occasionally we all sort of forget, though, how the process works and why it works the way we do. And so I'm excited that you're with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
All right. So is there anything, Bob, that you actually didn't know that you had to look up in advance of this show? I mean, that's sort of cheating to make you answer that question. But is there anything you don't know?
Oh, there are many things I don't know or things that I knew, but I then forgot. So, one thing that was interesting for me was when Vermont decided to go to a two-year, from a two-year session to a one-year session, basically. In the first 100 years of Vermont history, lawmakers came for a one-year term. And then in the late 1870s, it was switched to a two-year term. And the idea was lawmakers would come back every January, and then they didn't need to come back the second year unless there was a special session. And there were quite a few special sessions during the 1920s and 1930s. But the idea was, hey, lawmakers only have to be here 1 year, and they can skip the next year. But that changes in the 1960s when we go to lawmakers coming back every January. And of course, that has a huge impact on the operations and the impact of the lawmakers.
Is there ever any chatter about going to a biennium where lawmakers meet in the first year and then don't meet in that second year? Again, going back
to
that?
I don't think... There are a few people who would like that, but I don't think that's very realistic. I think maybe what some people talk about is, how about if we would restrict how long a session could be constitutionally? There's a proposal out there to look at maybe 90 days and say, and some states do this. They say the legislature will be in session for 60 days, 75 days, 90 days. Bingo, that's it. If things haven't passed by then, they have to wait until the next year. There's some talk about that at the State House, but I don't think it has a lot of support.
Don't we? I mean, we don't have that, Bob, but don't we have a sense at the beginning of the session how long it's going to last? I mean, we always have, it's like when school gets out, you know, it doesn't always hit that date exactly, but I thought we always know approximately when the legislature is planning to close up for the year.
Well, I think what we know, Jane, is that for the two-year period that the legislature has money to operate for about 36 weeks, and most people think of it, okay, the first year will be 18 and the second year will be 18, but then if that first year goes a little longer, folks will say, well, we'll just shorten the second year of the session. So we do have some parameters, no doubt about it. 18 weeks is a good way to look at it, and occasionally we'll find that the legislature will go into overtime at the end of the second year of the session.
Right, because when you talk about how much money they have to operate, I'd love it if you could go into that a little bit. I don't think we think about that so much, but not only lawmaker salaries, but their per diems, but also all of the work that goes into keeping the State House running, from the cafeteria to, you know, the heating, et cetera, et cetera. That obviously all has to be budgeted.
Absolutely. And, you know, it runs in the neighborhood of $300,000 a week. When you add lawmaker salaries to all the people, support staff, and having the State House open, as you mentioned. So when the legislature decides to stay and go overtime for 2 or 3 weeks, we're starting to talk about real money and approaching $1 million.
So beyond that, Bob, beyond the sort of nuts and bolts of running the State House, what happens in those 2 years? Can you talk about the difference between the first half of the biennium and the second half, the second year, which we're entering tomorrow?
Sure. You know, Jane, there's a really big difference. You know, lawmakers now are really ready to go right from the start. Now, last year at this time, they were still waiting for their committee assignments. A lot of new lawmakers were there just trying to figure out where the committee rooms were. Bills were very slowly introduced. It took a couple of weeks for these committees to come up to speed. Now those committees have had a year of experience. They're well organized. They're familiar with many of the issues. They've got bills left over from last year that didn't make it through, so the committees have work to do from day one. My guess is that by Friday, virtually all the committees will have set their priorities for the year, and then they'll be really off and running next Tuesday. We have the governor's State of the State address on Thursday afternoon. That helps accelerate the process. So things are really active, very active in the second year of the session from the very beginning.
We're talking today about how the legislature operates, what it's like, who's in the legislature, and we're going to talk as well about how bills actually become law. I think a lot of us learned this in civics class and through osmosis in some ways, but it's nice to have a reminder, because as we move into the session, the second year of the session, we want to know as citizens what's happening, how it works, and how we can get involved. And so Bob Kinzel and I are going to talk a little bit about that as well. And we want to know what questions you have about how it all works. So if you have questions about the demographics of the legislature, what it means to have a citizen legislature, and do we really have one, or how bills move through the process, how is it determined whether a bill is going to start, or legislation and debate is going to start in the House or the Senate, and what is crossover? All of these things are things we can discuss with your help and your questions. So hit them, hit us. Hit us with the questions. 1-800-639-2211 or post on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.org. Again, 1-800-639-2211. Bob, you said that the first year and the second year are typically very different, partly because there's no ramp up in the second year, the committees are assigned, et cetera, et cetera. But we know also that what the lawmakers are working on can change from year one to year two. And I'm curious, sort of philosophically, if usually lawmakers are trying to get down to business on the really big issues and some of the ones that are currently on the table, like minimum wage, paid family leave, cannabis tax and regulation, a sort of a framework for that. if the lawmakers try to tackle and complete those in year one, and then in year two, it's like, oh, the things that are nice to debate, we'll talk about those in year two. Or if they know that the thorny issues are going to be so thorny that they're going to get kicked to year two automatically.
I think for the most part, they know it's going to get kicked to year two. There are a lot of bills that might make it through the House or the Senate, but not the other chamber in the first year. And I think with some of the more difficult issues, that's kind of the pattern that we find. For a bill to make it through the House and the Senate and get signed into law by the governor in the first year, the bill has to have a lot of support and not be very controversial. So I think what we saw last year was lawmakers addressing some of these thorny issues. In some cases, the House and the Senate passed different versions of the bill, but were unable to agree on a final compromise. And so now, dealing with some of the tough issues right from the start of this session, we're going to see, as you mentioned, I think, proposals for raising the state minimum wage, paid family leave, tax and regulate cannabis, climate change. I think we're going to see the outline of some of these big bills in the first month of the session.
And are some of those issues that you just mentioned things that lawmakers have been working on over the summer? Because a lot of them, it's like they start work, but there needs to be more research done. And I know people sort of roll their eyes at the idea of a study committee or a summer study, but sometimes that's necessary to try to figure out, you know, how are we actually going to make this legislation work? So is a lot of that work actually done over the summer in between the 2 years?
On some of the very thorny issues, the answer is yes. Those summer study committees take a look at some of the details involved in those issues. You know, the cannabis bill is one to take a look at with the whole idea of tax and regulate or simply legalize the way that it is, or people who are against it. You know, a lot of it's going to come down to saliva testing and roadside testing. The governor feels very, very strongly about that. And so key committees have been looking at this issue. How do other states deal with this? That's something that lawmakers like to do. You know, they can look at the experience. I think there are 8 or 9 or 10 states now that have legalized marijuana. How do the ones that have a tax and regulate system, how do they deal with these issues of driver impairment? And so over the course of the summer, you've got groups of people who have been able to look at that issue. So when they come back now next week, when they really get into this in earnest, you know, they have some information to base their opinions on.
Bob, is it tricky for lawmakers to do this work and the really hard work of the things that are going to be contentious or complex in the second year when they are also running for re-election, and so is the governor, if they are choosing to try to stay in their positions? I mean, is that tricky to do both, or does the real electioneering stuff tend to happen once the session is over?
No, it's going to happen during the session, Jane, and it really sets people up to decide when they have a particular issue. Well, let's look at the minimum wage, for instance. Do the Democrats want to push through a plan for a $15 an hour minimum wage that would go into effect perhaps in 2025, knowing that the governor is going to veto it? Is that what they want to do? Because in the end, what they then have set up is an election issue for November, right? Or do they drop back a little bit and say, okay, let's try something like $12 or $13 an hour over the next year or two, and see if we can get the governor to agree to that? Paid family leave, very much the same way. Should it be a voluntary plan? Should it be a mandatory plan? Do lawmakers want to try to reach a compromise with the governor? Or do they stick to their guns and say, these are the essential factors and the essential components of this bill, and we're not going to give an inch on them? So you're going to find election year politics sprinkled throughout this entire session.
We are talking with VPR's seasoned political reporter and Vermont Edition host Bob Kinzel, who's doing a sort of live version of his Ask Bob series that you sometimes hear on Morning Edition. And we're basically going to the root of how the legislature operates. So, Bob, let's talk about who's in the legislature. 180 lawmakers, 30 in the Senate, 150 in the House. How is that all determined?
Well, we certainly have our legislative elections, and in the Senate we have our county districts. And in fact, one interesting change, Jane, I think during this upcoming session will be to look at the Chittenden County delegation. Right now, there are six members elected from Chittenden County. That is by far the largest state Senate district in the country. The next closest one is three members, and Vermont actually has several districts with three. So there is going to be a look this year in the second half of the session to break the Chittenden County district into two parts. So it'll be 2 3-member districts. And then across in the House, where you mentioned there are 150 members, about two-thirds of those districts are places where two members are elected. The other are single-member districts. And I think if you look at the age of the people who serve in the legislature, my recollection is both the House and the Senate, the average age is somewhere in the low 60s. And one reason why that might be true is legislative pay. Lawmakers don't make a lot of money. I think on average, you could say they make about $16,000 or $17,000 a year. It differs whether or not you get a housing allowance. You know, if you're representing Brattleboro and you need to have an apartment up in Montpelier for the winter, also mileage. So there, it varies a little bit, but that's probably a good place to start. And for that, you know, and you're also serving 5 months in Montpelier, so you got to have a job that says, okay, don't be here for 5 months, but then come back for 7.
Right.
And that usually means, I don't know, maybe you're retired, you're self-employed, you have other sources of income. And I think there are a number of people who feel that this legislative pay, where it is, creates some very serious obstacles for younger people to serve in the legislature. And I think they make a pretty good case. But then it's, you know, how do you fix it? Because Vermont prides itself on having a citizen's legislature, not a professional legislature as in other states. I mean, lawmakers here have no private staff. They have no offices. I remember the very first day I walked into the State House looking for former state Senator Bill Doyle. And I stopped and asked a member of the staff, could they tell me where Senator Doyle's office was? And everybody had a good chuckle because lawmakers don't have offices. They have their committee rooms, but that's all that they have. The other factor here, too, is that lawmakers do work in the 7 months that they're not in Montpelier. They have constituent services that they do, and yet they get no money for that. So there are some proposals out there that say, okay, how about if we give lawmakers an annual salary? Maybe it's $30,000. Maybe it's $35,000. It reflects the fact that they're working all year long. And also, it will enable some people to serve in the legislature because they can afford to now. But that runs into this whole idea of a citizen's legislature, and it would be a very sharp debate.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, and we won't have that debate here today, Bob, but it is interesting if Vermont wants a quote-unquote citizen legislature, whether perhaps paying more or offering more benefits would actually go a long way toward getting a modern citizen legislature. And so I think that will be an interesting debate to follow. But let's actually talk to someone who was a young lawmaker who can give us a little insight into what it's like to try to do this when you're not somebody who's retired or necessarily independently wealthy. Keisha Rahm represented Burlington voters in the Vermont House between 2009 and 2016, and she now works for a number of communities and organizations on cultural and generational diversity issues. Keisha, it's nice to talk with you again.
Thanks so much for having me, Jane and Bob. It's great to be with you.
How old were you when you actually started work as a lawmaker?
So I was actually a newly minted 22-year-old when I was on Vermont Edition talking about what it would be like to serve back then. That was 12 years ago now. So I feel like I'm a little older and wiser, but hopefully not any more cynical. It's an incredible place to serve.
Well, you know, you were one of the youngest people ever to serve, and you served for a long time. And I'm curious, now that you can have a little bit of space to reflect on it, what you think the barriers are to young people serving as lawmakers and what you found hardest about being young in the legislature?
Well, you know, first I would say it was an incredible privilege, and I felt lucky to be essentially raised by a lot of other legislators in my 20s, having a lot of parents and grandparents who taught me how to stand up straight and deliver a speech on the floor, or what it took to convince somebody to vote for your bill. I would not trade those years in my 20s for anything. I felt privileged. And at the same time, I remember during my first week in the legislature, Representative Jim Maslin from Thetford came up to me. He saw me alone on the floor, and he said, "Hey, we're pooling together to create an insurance pool if you want to join." And I lit up and started unloading. I thought I would have health care, and I don't, and I'm so glad to hear that. And his face darkened, and he said, "Oh, I meant life insurance." So, you know, it's one of those things where you don't really know until you get there how many barriers you might face. And this was before the Affordable Care Act. So even just having health care support or things like that certainly would make it easier for young people to think about.
Yeah, I mean, do you see that question of working for only a few months each year, you know, the first quarter of the year, essentially a little bit more than that, and but then not being paid for a full year? Is the pay an issue, as Bob was talking about, you know, that being paid a little bit more, or at least getting those benefits like health care, would entice people who might otherwise not be able to afford it into the body?
Well, absolutely. I think people across generations and the age spectrum sometimes face that barrier of how will I engineer my life and be able to afford to serve. I actually think when I was in my early 20s, it was the easiest time to think about going to Montpelier and serving. It was the start of the Great Recession, and a lot of my friends were sleeping on their parents' couches. So having a real job was actually tremendous at the time. But then as I was a young person in my 20s serving for 8 years and I wanted to buy a house and make other life decisions, that really started to become a barrier to think about staying there and continuing to get 2% pay raises every year. Is that.
Keisha, not to to dive into your personal life too much, but are there social barriers? I mean, if you're all of your colleagues are a generation or so older than you and you're in your 20s and you're, as you said, like thinking about, am I going to buy a house? Where am I going to stay? Who are my friends? How often do I get to go out with them? Am I going to date? That kind of thing. I mean, is that a challenge for young people?
I always had to rewire my brain, it felt like, to go home and hang out with my friends on Church Street after 5 months with my close friends being, you know, twice or more my age, and just learn how to talk like a young person again. So there's a lot of barriers for young people in that regard. And I didn't know until I talked to other younger women serving in their legislatures around the country that a lot of us do face this barrier of you're a young woman in your 20s trying to be taken as seriously as your colleagues and dress the part and have a social life at the same time. And how do you balance that with everyone in town, you know, knowing your name and seeing your lawn sign on the street and trying to date or just have a normal life at home? So yes, there are universal barriers, I think, that young people face, but it's such an important perspective to have at the same time in the legislature. The last study I saw was 2013 that talked about the number of young people serving in elected office from school board to Congress, and it's about 5% of the overall elected officials are under the age of 35, and of that, about 1.5% or a quarter of that 5% are young women under the age of 35. And when we think about so many political debates, a lot of them center around the bodies and the economics of women under the age of 35. So we absolutely have to be on the table, regardless of the social and dating barriers, it might present.
Keisha Rahm, she represented Burlington voters in the Vermont House between 2009 and 2016. Keisha, nice to talk with you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, and have a great session, everybody.
And Bob Kinzel, back to you here. You know, as we think about the demographics of the legislature, it's not just about age, and obviously it is certainly spread out geographically because it has to be. But what about the party makeup? What is the current makeup of the Vermont legislature in terms of party distribution?
Well, we see huge Democratic majorities in both the House and the Senate. Over in the Senate, there are six Republicans. That's the smallest number, I think, that ever have been in the Republican caucus in the Vermont Senate in the history of the state. In the House, we have 95 Democrats. We have 43 Republicans. We also have, I believe, 7 progressives and 5 independents in the House. So the Democrats have these very, very large majorities. And some people will look at this and say, well, it's a supermajority. It's veto-proof. They can do whatever they want. And that's just not the reality of the situation. As we look at individual issues, again, looking at paid family leave, looking at raising the minimum wage, there are some Democrats who have problems with these ideas. They don't want to have a payroll tax for paid family leave. They're concerned about how raising the minimum wage will affect smaller businesses across the state. So you can't count on all of them in the event that the governor vetoes a bill and there's a vote on the House or Senate floor to override. So the Democrats have that position of having very, very big majorities, but it's not like they can do whatever they want to do. There really is a check and balance here.
Yeah, it's interesting to see as the Democrats continue to have such a sort of large majority in the legislature that you can see these factions emerge among the Democrats and the sort of left side of the legislature. And to Bob, what you said, that question of who can get what passed, although it certainly does change what the priorities are, you know, sort of the broad strokes Democratic priorities. And I want to hear a little bit more about what it's like then to operate in the minority and how to make sure that your voice is heard and your perspective and the issues that are important to you and the constituents who voted for you get heard. So to that, let's talk to Don Turner, a Republican who served in the House from 2006 to 2018 and was the minority leader from 2011 to 2018. Don Turner, nice to talk with you again.
Hey, it's nice talking with you, Jane and Bob. I appreciate the opportunity to be on the show, and it was great listening to Keisha, who I served with, had the pleasure to serve with when I was there.
Yeah, I mean, it must be different now. You were in the legislature for so long, and now you're not, and you are town manager for Milton. And we've talked to you in the past about the many, many jobs that you have held over the years, the civic jobs. But I'm curious specifically about this question of how, as a Republican, when you have and pretty much know you're going to have a Democratic majority or even a supermajority, whether or not it can actually go that way. How do you make sure that your voice is heard?
Well, what we did, Jane, it's challenging. It's very frustrating, and it's a lot of work. But we all go there, all 180 legislators, and I appreciate and respect all the colleagues I served with and the people that are there now, to do what's best for Vermont and what we believe is best for Vermont. So what I found over the years, it was in formulating the goals of the caucus, was to listen to members and then setting goals prior to the session. And then when we got to the session, we proposed bills that supported those goals. But it's all about people and working with people. And, you know, party, you know, you have your party allegiance, everyone does. But you could find some common goals across all party lines. And I found that to be the way we try to get things done. And I got to say, it is frustrating serving in the minority, but people are there for the right reason, I believe. And you have to build alliances, and that means building alliances across party lines through, you know, statewide office holders, governor, lieutenant governor, treasurer. I had a number of times over the years I worked with the treasurer on some pension issues, and we got bills passed because the treasurer understood and what was best for Vermont. So we worked with Beth over the years. And then what I did too is I would encourage our caucus members, and before I was a caucus leadership, we created caucuses on specific issues. And they were generally around fiscal issues. There are a lot of Democrats, independents that feel very strongly about fiscal things, financial issues, taxes, raising fees, and so on. So we formed little caucuses within the bodies, and we worked through them. I found myself going into the Senate talking to senators who were much more moderate Democrats, such as Senator Mazza, Senator Sears, those people, working with them and building relationships. At the end of the day, Jane, it's about building relationships and doing what's best for Vermont. And that's how we got things done.
So, Don, when you're in the legislature, though, and you spent a long time there, and so you had built these relationships and you knew your way around, But when it comes then to recruiting new Republicans to run for office and to continue the priorities that your party has and that Vermonters who vote Republican have, how do you do that when it seems like it could be an impediment to even thinking about running if you think, I don't even know if I have a chance. And once I get there, how am I going to get anything done? Not to mention the fact that often the official Vermont Republican Party doesn't seem well aligned with the Republican legislators who are actually in the House and Senate. So how do you help recruitment?
Well, I'm still doing that, Jean, for those out there listening. I've been working. I put a PAC together to try to recruit candidates, and I'm meeting with candidates around the state. But it is very challenging to recruit Republicans today. You know, what I try to do is focus on specific issues, just as I told you I did to work and move legislation, is to find issues. And most people today that I'm talking to are fiscally, financially conservative. We don't get into a lot of the other social issues. But it is very challenging, and I'm looking for people. Kesha did a really good job, and I think Bob pointed out on what the impediments are for people to serve. I don't care what party you are involved in. Those apply to all. But what I've done is focused on people with non-traditional work schedules, people like realtors, and that's one of the jobs that I had, insurance agents, people that can do their job outside the 8 to 9 to 5 day. So those are important places, but you got to find people that are focused and committed to those financial issues is what I've done. But it's very hard. It's very hard to get Republicans, especially young Republicans today when, you know, we have all the other parties that are offering higher pay, free health care, free college, and so on. It's hard to get a young person who maybe is just coming out of college or going into the workforce to understand that these things are not really free. Somebody's paying at some point. So it is a challenge, but again, focusing on financial is what's been successful for me, and that's what I'll continue to do when I'm recruiting, and that's what I recommend that people are interested. If they want to get involved, find something that you can really focus on and focus on that cause, that issue.
Well, Don Turner's still working to try to get people into the legislature, though he is not in there anymore. Now, town manager for Milton, was minority leader from 2011 to 2018 and started in the Vermont House in 2006. Don, nice to talk with you. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Jane. Take care.
All right. Before we end today, let's go to Carrie, who's calling in from Marshfield. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Jane. I'll be quick. I just wanted to comment on the way that people are not only calling our representatives lawmakers, but viewing that as their primary job. They're meant to be our representatives. We are, the government is of, by, and for the people. They should not be doing anything without a plurality of their constituents approaching them, wanting something done. Having a group of people, we're paying a good salary, and now you guys are talking about benefits, to make a career for themselves, creating laws for us to follow, is insanity.
So, Carrie, you like the citizen legislature idea. You like that it's these are people who come in and their job is to follow what the people who voted for them want.
Absolutely. That's what our government is meant to be.
Well, Carrie, I appreciate you saying that. And, you know, I think you also helped lead us into what we're going to just end on today, Bob, which is this question of, okay, so you elected someone. That's probably not the end of your responsibility as a constituent who wants to see things get done in Montpelier. So what can people actually do to follow the issues that are priorities for them and to see what their represented officials are doing?
Well, Jane, I should mention that citizen involvement, I think, is very important to the legislative process. And I'm always amazed when I talk to lawmakers who tell me if they get 10 real letters from individuals, not emails or petitions that are mass marketed, but 10 real letters from constituents, that has an enormous impact on them. 10 letters.
That's all it takes?
That's all it takes. I think lawmakers enjoy hearing from people. And I should say that the legislative process is very open. So if you're listening to this and you'd like to follow what's happening at the legislature, the best way to do that is to go to the legislative website, and that's legislature.vermont.gov. Legislature.vermont.gov. house.vermont.gov. When you go to that homepage, you can click on the House or the Senate. You can see their calendar for the day. There's something called the notice calendar, which is going to tell you what's happening tomorrow. Perhaps you're interested in following a specific committee. You can click on the committee sites and see what every committee in the State House is doing for that week, what they're planning all day long, who are the witnesses that are coming in to testify. Sometimes these things get jumbled up a little bit, but you have a pretty good idea on Monday what's going to unfold for the entire week at the State House. And if you're following a particular bill, you can also, there's a bill tracker, so you can say, okay, here's a bill I'm very interested in, the tax and regulate cannabis bill. I want to see what happens, what committee is it in, how have the different committees proposed amendments to it, how, when the bill came to the House or Senate floor, how was it debated, what amendments were considered at that time. So you can really follow what's happening at the State House through their website. And I'll just put in a quick plug for the VPR legislative stream. If you're at home and you hear and you look at the legislative website and you see that on the action calendar today they're going to be debating a certain issue and you'd like to listen in on that debate, VPR has legislative streams for both the House and the Senate, and you can listen to everything that happens on the floor.
Well, Bob, I'm glad that you left it there, and we're going to put links on today's show page so everybody can figure all of this out. I agree, the legislative website, really key to figuring out what's going on and to reading bills as they're moving through the process. We're going to have to do that how a bill becomes a law thing in a later show. But, Bob, I so appreciate your time here. Thank you for getting us prepped and ready for the 2020 second half of the biennium.
My pleasure, Jane.
VPR's Bob Kinzel is a Capital Bureau reporter and Friday Vermont Edition host. And Bob is going to switch seats with our other State House reporter, Peter Hirschfeld. We'll be talking very briefly about some of the issues that you are going to want to keep an eye on in 2020 as lawmakers or representatives, as Kerry would like us to call them, come back into session and work on these big issues on behalf of all of us. Nice to talk with you, Pete.
Happy opening day of the legislative session, Eve.
So before we get to the second half of the biennium, we should probably know what we were working with in the first half. So what do we need to remember from 2019 as we move into 2020?
Well, I won't belabor everything that happened in 2019, Jane, but the thing that's still fresh on a lot of people's minds from last year is the way the session ended, which was pretty messily. House and Senate leaders had been talking a big game all session long about passing paid family leave and increasing the minimum wage. And most people in the building, Democrats and Republicans alike, figured this was a foregone conclusion that they would pass. But things fell apart in the final days of the last session, and in a pretty spectacular way, House and Senate negotiators quickly found themselves at odds over some really basic elements of those proposals. And so that's something that a lot of folks have in their minds heading into 2020.
Not only a lot of constituents, but even the House and Senate leaders themselves, you've been hearing from them about how they're how that worked and what they think is going to happen now.
Yeah, well, they are very bullish right now. You know, there was a lot of contention in the last part of the session, but they say they are really feeling like they have done some hard work during the off session. House Speaker Mitzi Johnson, Senate President Tim Ash have been meeting. So have many of those leaders that were involved in those negotiations. And House Speaker Mitzi Johnson said recently that things are looking pretty good right now.
You've all tried to get some juicy mileage out of a Mitzi Tim story. But you're forgetting the core of this is that this isn't about Mitzi and Tim. This is about the 180 people that we collectively represent.
So, you know, a lot of people in the building thought that what happened during the last hours of the last legislative session was symptomatic of some underlying tension between Mitzi Johnson and Tim Ash. Both of them really dismissed that, though, in recent weeks. And they say the difficulty around those negotiations and their inability to find consensus was really a product of the complexity of the issues, not because of their relationship.
So, you know, let's look at some of the issues then, Pete, that they're going to be working on here. And you know, we're going to go into them as they are through our reporting and through your reporting as the session progresses. But let's get a sense of some of the big ones that we know are going to be really grappled over. Paid family leave is, of course, a really big one. And the governor has sort of preempted the legislature on that score a little bit. So what's the crux of the debate going to be?
Well, Democrats in the House and Senate appear to have landed on a compromise plan for paid family leave. Recall that the original proposal would have covered paid leave for the birth of a newborn or to take care of an ailing family member or to take leave for personal illness. The paid leave compromise we're likely to see in the coming weeks will not cover leave for personal illness, and that's a big deal because in other states that have paid leave programs, personal illness is the number one reason that people draw down that benefit. The Senate, though, is very concerned with the price tag of the paid leave benefit with that personal illness provision in there, and the House has grudgingly agreed to leave it out in order to get the votes they need in the Senate. Zooming out, though, there is a broader fight between Democrats and Republican Governor Phil Scott. Scott doesn't like even the pared-down version of Democrats' paid leave plan because it's mandatory. Everybody's in, everybody pays, whether they want the benefit or not. Phil Scott wants a paid leave bill, but he's pushing for a voluntary plan. He's all but promised to veto a mandatory proposal. So Democrats are going to be looking to muster the votes they would need to override that veto. If they can't get there, though, they're going to have to make a decision. Do we squelch paid leave altogether for this year, or do we allow the governor to proceed with a voluntary statewide paid leave plan?
Is there a potential for a governor's veto as well on a minimum wage bill if lawmakers move forward with a $15 minimum wage?
Well, let's start with that number you just used there, $15 an hour. Of course, when Democrats began this conversation in 2019, they were calling for, promising actually, a bill that would increase the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Democrats, though, from rural parts of the state especially, ended up having some real concerns about what a $15 minimum wage would do to local economies. So the compromise bill that we're going to see emerge in the next few weeks will probably be closer to $12 or $13 an hour. Again, though, Republican Governor Phil Scott just philosophically opposes any legislatively mandated increase in the minimum wage. He says the free market, especially in this time of such low unemployment, will take care of wage growth on its own. And he signaled he'll be vetoing the minimum wage bill as well. The question, again, is whether Democrats can find the votes in both chambers for an override.
All right. So we've got more issues, obviously, that they're going to be working on and not enough time to go into depth on them. But a couple that I want to mention, and Pete, you can take your pick. Act 250, the legislature had a study committee looking at revamping these development restrictions and regulations before the session even started last year, but we didn't see a lot of progress. We know we're going to be talking about a tax and regulate system for cannabis. Climate change is something we're hearing a ton of from lawmakers about what they want to talk about this session. So where do you see another really big debate coming?
Well, I think the last one you touched on is going to be a huge debate in Montpelier this year. Climate change is something that lawmakers have been hearing a lot about from their constituents, and Democratic lawmakers say it is time to pass legislation that mandates reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. That's not something Vermont has ever done before, but some of the proposals they're considering would probably have the effect of raising the price of fossil fuels, namely gasoline and on-road diesel. And Phil Scott has made it very clear that he's going to be incredibly leery of any climate bills that would have the effect of increasing prices at the pump.
Any sleeper issues that you've got your eye on that you think we should know about?
You know, I guess I'm just really looking forward to hearing the governor's State of the State address. We've heard a lot from legislators about what their agenda looks like. Phil Scott has held his a lot closer to the vest, and I think on Thursday we may get a preview of some of the big policy proposals we can expect to see in his budget address later this month.
And make sure you stay with VPR. We will have live coverage of the State of the State address at 2 p.m. on Thursday. Reporter Peter Hirschfeld works out of VPR's Capitol Bureau, and you'll be hearing his reporting all session. Pete, thanks very much.
Thank you, Jane.
And that'll do it for today. Tomorrow, as we've talked about, we are going to take you inside the State House as lawmakers return to Montpelier, broadcasting live from the Capitol's Cedar Creek Room with the sounds and voices of the State House on opening day. We're going to hear from more than 20 lawmakers about unfinished business and their top priorities for this year, plus the food at the State House cafeteria, the teenagers who joined the PAGE program to see government in action, and more. So join us live at the State House tomorrow at noon. Today's show was directed by James Stewart. Our production team includes managing producer Lydia Brown and producer Matthew Smith, with support from Anna St. Marie. VPR's digital producers are Meg Malone and Elodie Reed, and our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.